This year marks the 50th anniversary of the passing of the groundbreaking Civil Rights Act of 1964. That landmark legislation gave the federal government the ability to strike down segregation in all institutions, to enforce fair hiring practices, and resolve bias in law enforcement and criminal courts. Although its passage is often attributed to the leadership of President Johnson and Martin Luther King, in his new book called The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act, Clay Risen reveals an enormous cast of characters who joined those two men in the civil rights battle. Mr. Risen is a staff editor for the op-ed section of the New York Times. His book is published by Bloomsbury Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can we call any piece of legislation the bill of the century?
Yeah, I think a bill like this, you know, it completely revolutionized race relations in this country, and it changed the way that the federal government stood vis-a-vis an enormous section of the public. I mean, the federal government had refused to back rights for African Americans for so long, and with one fell swoop, it changed that stance completely.
Well, hadn't there been an earlier civil rights bill passed in 1957?
Yeah, it was very weak. And really what it did was, it set up a civil rights division within the Justice Department. It made a few other sort of, steps here and there, but it really didn't change. It didn't make any sort of robust commitment to protecting rights.
Was it seen as a first step?
It depends on who you asked. Certainly to a lot of Southerners, it was taken as a kind of a safety valve or a release valve. You know, they knew there was pressure. This is how Johnson managed to get the bill through when he was Senate Majority Leader. He said, look, guys, you need to don't oppose this bill too strongly because there's a lot of people out there who want legislation. Let this through. It's not really going to change things. On the other hand, a lot of the supporters said, yeah, it's not a great bill, but it opened the door.
Well, he got more support from Southerners for that bill than he got when he was president with the 64 bill.
Sure.
Had he learned any lessons from his experiences in 57?
I think he did, and I think a lot of people did. I think that they realized that it was possible to they'd seen it happen. So civil rights wasn't an impossibility.
And then I'm assuming people thought, well, there'll be more legislation because once we got our foot in the door, and then John F. Kennedy was elected president on a platform that promised some civil rights legislation, that everything was going to move rather quickly.
There was that expectation, and then nothing really happened. I mean, Kennedy was not the fiery liberal on civil rights that I think a lot of people thought he would be.
It has been said that one of the reasons is he didn't really want to get tied up in this battle in his first term because he assumed he was going to have a second term. He was going to save it for later.
Yeah, who knows? I think he...
They also say that he was going to enter the war in Vietnam.
Yeah. I think he just didn't fundamentally understand the issue. This is a guy who grew up in, white upper class Massachusetts. And, on an abstract level, he certainly believed that equality should be there for all. But, look, if you look at Profiles in Courage, the pieces that he writes about the South, he's very critical of the abolitionists and very critical of the Reconstructionists. And he's much more sympathetic toward these Southerners like Lamar, who was a Confederate, later a Supreme Court justice. And this was a guy who wanted to reconcile things, who wanted to move forward peacefully. And I think Kennedy wanted that same kind of thing under his administration.
But he did propose a first draft of the bill before he died in 1963.
One of the things that I try to document very carefully is that he came around. And through the course of 1960, I really think starting with the Oxford crisis and the James Meredith integration crisis, he started to realize that things were not going to move on their own.
He felt pushed by what was happening in the country.
That's the argument I make, and also by his brother. I mean, Bobby Kennedy is another guy who, in the 50s and early 60s, was just not seen as somebody who is sympathetic toward really anybody at all, but certainly not African Americans. And yet he too, through the early part of 1963, began to have this kind of moral awakening.
And by the time he was assassinated, he was seen as somebody with a very strong position on civil rights.
Absolutely. Bobby Kennedy is a fascinating character in his own right.
Did JFK think that a civil rights bill could pass through the Congress?
Yeah, I think that Kennedy really understood the mood of the country, I think he thought it was risky. I think he believed it could pass, but it would take a lot of political capital. But yeah, now, you know, the question is, would he have compromised? And that's something no one knows.
I mean, well, how does he go ahead.
No, I mean, would he have accepted half a loaf, having written and then written a strong bill, accepted an even stronger bill as it moved through the House? You know, we'll never know, but you could maybe look at certain things and say, yeah, he probably would have walked back on certain parts of the bill. Who knows?
Just compromise to get it passed.
That's right.
That's what presidents do.
Yeah, and that's what Johnson did in what Eisenhower did in 57. So there was certainly precedent. That was sort of par for the course on civil rights.
Well, how did Kennedy's bill compare to Johnson's bill?
Well, there wasn't really Johnson's bill. Johnson didn't touch the bill. You know, by the time Kennedy was assassinated, the bill was more or less as it was when it passed. There were some tweaks and a few small compromises. Sex discrimination was added to Title VII, but that happened on the House floor. Johnson didn't really have much to do with the writing of the bill. You know, his action was elsewhere.
Well, he had wanted to get more involved with Congress, and the Kennedys kind of prevented him from doing
it. Yeah, although also, you know, Congress prevented him from doing it too. I mean, one of the things, the image of him as the master of the Senate is true, but it also leaves out the fact that a lot of people didn't like him when he was running the Senate. And as soon as he went to the White House, they more or less exiled him. And it took a lot for him to kind of claw his way back.
Was he in favor of a strong Civil Rights Act when Kennedy was alive?
Yes, absolutely. And there are some great tapes of the cabinet and the kind of inner circle where Johnson was allowed occasionally, where they're talking about the bill. And Johnson was very much in support of a strong bill.
He also spoke against Kennedy's position of gradualism and taking it slow.
Yeah, you know, there are some speeches that he made in early 63 that are sort of, I mean, it's funny, you see these things sort of pop up again with the kind of things Joe Biden has said in terms of, you know, maybe letting the horse out of the barn, but on gay marriage, you know, before Obama took a stand, Joe Biden did. And, you know, arguably forced President Obama to be a little more forthright on gay marriage. Same thing happened with civil rights. Johnson was giving speeches where he gave the speech in Gettysburg to mark the anniversary of the battle. And he was very adamant about civil rights action now. And I think that made Kennedy, take a step where he might not otherwise have.
Was that a surprise? After all, he was put on the ticket to get the vote of the southern states for Kennedy.
I think it was a surprise for Kennedy.
And he is from the South, and he had voted against civil rights measures earlier in his career.
Yeah.
Had he had a total turnabout himself?
Well, I don't think it was a turnabout. I mean, I think what Bob Caro writes about Johnson is probably true, that, you know, this was a guy who was fiercely pragmatic, Machiavellian perhaps, but also had a moral core that was just very insulated. And as he moved into the White House, first as vice president and then as president, he didn't need that wrapping. So I mean, he stayed a pragmatist and a Machiavellian in certain ways, but he also allowed that kind of moral sense to come forward. And I think that's what you see happening through his vice presidency.
Well, you write that the idea, I'm quoting, that King and Johnson were the dominant figures behind the Civil Rights Act not only distorts the history of the act, but also the process of American legislative policymaking in general. And yet, the cover photograph is of Johnson and King.
Sure. Well, I think that, they're both iconic figures. And I think that, you know, for me, looking at the photograph, they represent what I think are two sides. It took the interaction between the political process and the movement side to get things going.
Well, yesterday we had Todd Purdom here, and he talked about the role that William McCulloch played and also Everett Dirksen, two conservative mm-hmm. Republicans, in getting this passed. And we talked about how that might not happen today. In fact, William McCulloch was in the same seat that now John Boehner mm-hmm. now holds.
Sure, sure. I mean, those guys probably wouldn't be welcome in today's party, or at least their ability to take the kinds of positions that they did would be pretty circumscribed.
But because McCulloch was a conservative, and mm-hmm. also Everett Dirksen, and they supported this bill, do you think that helped them get other conservatives to go along?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, guys that were much more liberal and had been on the record supporting civil rights, like John Lindsay in the House, Jacob Javits, both New Yorkers, in the Senate, they were very liberal Republicans. And, you know, their poll was minimal, even though they were, you know, very smart and very forthright. But they just didn't have that reach with the conservatives.
Well, Emanuel Seller in the House, who
was
responsible for some of the amendments. Mm-hmm. But he, I can't imagine he was all that popular in the South either.
No. Seller was not particularly popular.
And Southern Democratic senators staged a filibuster that ran 54 days. Mm-hmm. In the end, was that just a futile act?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that is sort of the tension or the exciting part about the filibuster is the mood of the country was changing. You had a very strong group of people around the country, a movement supporting the bill, but also if you looked at the polls, people were turning against civil rights. And that was the bet of the Southerners, was that they could hold out until that mood really sort of locked in.
Well, were they able to weaken the bill at all in the Senate?
No. In fact, I mean, the Southerners are more kind of, they're this sort of immovable obstacle that the other forces in play had to work around. But they were very much opposed to anything. So there wasn't much negotiation going on.
And then Mike Mansfield, the Senate Majority Leader, had the bill, he brought it to the full Senate rather than having it go through the Judiciary Committee.
Right. Well, that was something that was a lesson that he learned from previous legislation, previous civil rights bills. You know, the Judiciary Committee was run by Jim Eastland, who was, a real adamant segregationist from Mississippi.
So he would have just killed it?
And he would have killed it. He could have sat on it for as long as he wanted. In fact, there was a parallel. You know, this bill, the bill that ended up passing, was the House version. But there was a parallel Senate version that they introduced just to have something on every plate. And that's effectively what he did to the Senate version. He just sat on it, essentially said, I'm never going to let this out of my committee.
My guest is Clay Risen, an editor of the New York Times op-ed section and a founding managing editor of the Quarterly Democracy, a journal of ideas. His book, The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act, is published by Bloomsbury. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Clay Risen, whose latest book is The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act, published by Bloomsbury. You mentioned James Eastland as being one of the obvious opponents. Many of the opponents, like Strom Thurmond, we would expect to be strong opponents. But what about Barry Goldwater? He's from Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, Goldwater really represented a new strain within the Republican Party, which was, you know, this very libertarian point of view, which you see today in guys like Rand Paul. Goldwater was he eventually left it, but he was a member of the NAACP. He was very much on record supporting civil rights
He had supported previous federal civil rights legislation.
Exactly. But he was opposed to Title II in particular, which said, you know, banned Jim Crow discrimination, said you can't you can't refuse to serve people because of their race in a restaurant. He was opposed to Title VII, which said, you know, you can't discriminate against people in the workplace. He thought this was a violation of people's property rights. Ultimately, I think that he gave a lot of succor to people who didn't want to admit that they were racist, but wanted a reason to oppose the bill. But I think he in his heart really did believe that this was the right thing to do.
And do you think that it hurt him in the presidential race?
Well, I think he was pretty much bound to lose anyway. It didn't help him, let's say. But, it helped him in the sense that he won a lot of the South that he probably would not have won otherwise.
And after the passage of the bill, Johnson said that he feared that he'd lose the support of the Southern states for the Democratic Party in that upcoming election. Of course, it's not just that election, but pretty much every election since. Do you think a direct result of this, or is it more the Southern strategy that Richard Nixon devised a few years later?
I think it's a whole lot of things. You know, in the mid-50s, Robert Penn Warren wrote his famous essay on segregation. And in it, he has a section, where a relatively short section, where he muses about why isn't the South Republican? And he says, you know, he sort of interviews a couple of Southern Republicans, which was very rare at the time. And he says, you know, I think this is where things are going. And I think Johnson saw that too. I think Johnson was, you know, perceptive enough to say, look, as the South becomes more middle class, as it joins the rest of the country, this is a place that just isn't connected to the Democratic Party. And all it is going to take is some Republicans making inroads. And you could already see that. I mean, that was one reason, I think, why a lot of Democrats were so adamant against the bill, because they were already being played by extremely segregationist Republicans.
And many Democrats, Southern Democrats, wound up switching parties, Strom Thurmond, yeah. Jesse Helms, and others.
Yeah, and very soon afterward, because they also saw the writing on the wall. They saw that that was where the party was going. And so by the time Nixon came along in 68, it was, you know, I mean, a novel strategy in some ways, but it was already something that you could say, yeah, this is how things are going to work. It wasn't a huge risk.
Now, this was about race, and yet – as you mentioned, a prohibition against discrimination based on sex was added to the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Did that upset certain people in the civil rights movement?
Well, yeah, in the sense that there were people who thought the bill really had to be focused on race, and that any time you add something else, particularly something, you know, that was controversial in its own right, you run the risk of alienating certain supporters.
Johnson was unyielding on the bill, as he was on most things during his presidency. What was King's role in the bill's passage?
Well, I think, you know, King really did two things. You know, first of all, three things, I guess. You know, first was Birmingham, and you know, the role that Birmingham played in getting Kennedy to actually put the bill in play is central. I don't think the bill would have happened without Birmingham. But then King also, during the March on Washington, gave his, you know, famously stirring speech. And the effect of that was to persuade millions of Americans, white Americans, that there was really a moral urgency. And then King, you know, he wasn't really a politician, but he met with Kennedy, he met with Johnson, and he just kept reminding them that, you know, this is something that has to happen.
But he was a leader of only one of the leading civil rights groups, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. There was also the NAACP, mm-hmm. The Urban League. There were some other groups that were perhaps radical?
Well, more radical. I mean, SNCC was certainly more radical. But I actually think the NAACP deserves a lot more credit on the bill.
Especially you say Clarence Mitchell,
the head lobbyist and the head of the Washington Bureau. I mean, these were folks who understood Washington. They were criticized by King and by SNCC, the student movement, for being too insidery, too establishment. But when it came to lobbying on the bill, these guys already knew who to talk to. They knew the buttons to push. And I don't think the bill would have been what it was without Clarence Mitchell.
And he was nicknamed the 101st U.S.
Right.
Senator.
Yeah.
He had that much clout?
Well, sure. And remember, this was a time when lobbying was not anywhere what it is today. I mean, we're used to these guys who go in and write bills and trade favors. But at the time, what Mitchell was doing was still kind of, you know, groundbreaking. And so, but yeah, he could go in and talk to Richard Russell. He could talk to Jim Eastland. And you know, these guys didn't respect each other, but he could be he was smooth and persuasive enough to at least whittle them down a little bit.
Well, what was his reaction to the compromises that Dirksen and some other Senate leaders made to the bill to overcome the filibuster?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Mitchell did was a lot of theater. You know, so he was always very adamant about getting a bill, a stronger bill, an even stronger bill, no compromises. When the compromises came through, he was angry, but I don't think he was really angry. I think he was very happy at what was going on, but he realized that he had to play this part in order to keep things from going even further toward compromise.
Well, it passed both houses by fairly comfortable margins.
Sure. I mean,
these were not close votes.
No, but this is the difference between a filibuster and, you know, the actual vote, you just needed a majority, but to beat the filibuster, you needed two-thirds, and that's where the real climax took place.
Well, right now, you need 60 votes
to
get anything considered. The Senate voted 71-29.
Yeah,
so
no,
under those circumstances, it would have gone through today as well.
Oh, absolutely. But keep in mind that when it first came to the Senate and they were taking polls, barely a majority supported a filibuster, and it was really the work of lobbyists on one hand, Justice Department officials, I mean, people, you know, really sort of working these midway, you know, these conservative Republicans, the people who are on the fence, working them over and over. And I think the Southern opposition to any compromise also eventually forced these guys to say, you know what, forget it. We're going to vote for cloture because we can't not vote for something.
It wasn't one of the problems that the civil rights movement wasn't represented by a single unified voice?
Yeah, I think it depends on – you can look at it both ways. I think that the fact that it was represented by several voices introduce a certain tension. Certainly there were different interests represented. At the same time –
A lot of egos involved.
A lot of egos involved. At the same time, I think that there's a value to that in that it introduces the image of diversity of voices, right? That there are – all these people are – maybe they disagree on certain things, but they're all adamantly behind this one thing. And that's why it was important to also get the different churches, synagogues, different labor, the UAW, steelworkers, all of these people on the same page. They had a lot of there's a lot of tension between the unions and civil rights groups, but they could get behind this bill. And I think that impressed on these wavering senators that, yeah, this is something the country wants.
The unions often had discrimination within their own practices.
Yeah, and it's important to note that the ones that did back the bill most strongly, steelworkers, UAW, were the more industrially oriented unions. The ones that came from kind of the craft side were a little slower going, and eventually they came around, but they didn't offer nearly the support that the industrial ones did.
Well, you mentioned that clergy from all groups were in strong support. Why do you think today we're not hearing an outcry as the Supreme Court makes decisions that have kind of cut away major provisions of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a religious scholar, but I think that there was a moment in the 50s and 60s when a very politically and socially engaged generation came up in the clergy, as well as among the laity, religiously committed everyday citizens who saw the need for social change and believed that the church had a role to play in that. I don't think that exists today in a grand sense, although you see it on some things like immigration, certainly on abortion from a different perspective.
Well, today we could say that Barack Obama is president to some degree because of this.
Oh, absolutely.
At the same time, there's a lot of resistance to him on race, so it cuts both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Clay Risen will be reading and signing books at Greenlight Bookstore Wednesday, April 9th at 7:30 p.m. That's at 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. More information on our show page at WNYC.org. And the book is The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.